Blades of light cut the dusty air, illumination quickly dissipating in the darkness sweeping down the granite corridor of the dungeon. Arrow could hear the echo of her deliberate clop resonate throughout the cavernous maw of the cave at the base of a great black spire. Obelisk Above Tempest Sea, or OATS for short, was an infamous dungeon crawl on the outskirts of Clip-Clop Cove that promised a prize beyond all comprehension, a satchel of the Oats of Eternity. The ascension to oat-fueled deity, the power to feed your nation for 100 years, the power to sow your oats across the globe, or just a thrill of unbridled glory, the Oats of Eternity have enticed many adventurers to their doom with just suggestion and hearsay. Four floors deep, getting hungry, the pangs strike the horse hard and she begins to pass out. Times are dire. In her inventory, Arrow has 3 bags of oats, but no scrolls of identified foodstuff. But even eating slightly spoiled oats is more desirable than starving to death on the cold, dank cobblestones of the dungeon. She ponders her 3 bags of oats, selects the dimly shimmering bag of delicious flavor oats, and begins to gorge herself. 3 mouthfuls in, she realizes that these are not oats at all, but rather acidic hydrochloric ticks. Their results are, naturally, fatal. Arrow wakes up in front of the infamous dungeon crawl on the outskirts of Clip-Clop Cove, the obelisk above Tempest Sea. Inside the gaping maw of the cave, braziers dance with fire, flashing against the highly polished marble floor. This is familiar, yet entirely different. She looks behind her. The village of Haystack Hamlet is still in sight. She could be in a warm stable with a belly of harsh whiskey tonight. But her legs move of their own accord towards the obelisk. And Arrow doesn't stop herself because, hey, those Oats of Eternity are supposed to be fucking legit. So, sort of the zeitgeist of the roguelike you keep playing. It's just the one more game mentality. So the podcast...
That was a beautiful intro.
The Arrowcast for February 2016. We'll be talking about the essence of roguelikes. But before we get to that, we have to talk about what we've been up to. Chris, you've decided to waste your leap day by recording the Arrowcast. Other than that, it only comes once every 4 years, and you decide to spend it on the Arrowcast. What have you been doing in February?
I don't know how you're saying this, wasting it. I mean, this is a good day to record the AgroCast. I love the AgroCast. You know, this has been our project for years, Matt, and you are just laying it down like that.
Yeah, it's a good time. It's a good time. worth the leap day. Worth the leap day.
But in any case, what I've been up to, I went to KatsuCon earlier in February. I regrettably was sick for most of it. I actually got a high fever constantly. I have no explanation for it other than I just got some nasty virus that plagued me. So, I just gotta say that for the times I was active, I decided to spend my time wisely, you know, keep it positive. It was unfortunate, but, you know, looking back on it, I did have a good time when I was active, and I was not feeling miserable. You know, I saw my friends, I got to dress up, get good photos. It was really cold that weekend, which probably didn't help. But, yeah, I gotta stay positive. So, it was a good time.
So, what kind of convention is this?
It's an anime convention. It was a week right before MAGFest, which is kind of ironic. MAGFest being the music and games convention. But I usually go for KatsuCon because it's usually scheduled better in the year. MAGFest used to be at the beginning of January, which is a really awkward time for me to go off of work. But KatsuCon is also just the bigger con for cosplaying, which I'm more into. So that's why I always go to that one.
Okay, cool. Well, it sounds like you had a good time in spite of illness, so that's not too bad.
Yeah. Even after that, I was still recovering, so I didn't get much done. And I've been bouncing around games, haven't been really dedicated to anything. I just kind of... floating about different games, not really settling anything. The one game I can't really talk about because we'll be talking about that later in the cast anyway. But the other game I just kind of focused on was the Sacred Stones. It's the 8th Fire Emblem game. It's about 2 siblings and the path kind of splits. You get to choose which path you want to go to. I originally beat Ephraim's path a long time ago, and now I'm finally doing Erica's on hard mode. This is supposed to be one of the easier Fire Emblems, and I'm dying a lot, which makes me question my abilities, but overall, it's going alright. I do enjoy it a lot. It's a very weird Fire Emblem with gameplay, because the RNG is more favored to the player, and you can actually grind in this game, which I always thought was a weird choice. But for Fire Emblem, it has a smaller cast, so I feel like that lets me appreciate the characters more. And it's the last GBA game, so I think the graphics look amazing. The sprites look really beautiful. I favor it a lot. It's just that gameplay is just always a down thing for me. It's a little nitpicky.
We were talking about Shining Force before the podcast started recording, and I would say that Sacred Stones actually takes some cues from Shining Force. If you had played both, like there's a lot of monstrous enemies in the Sacred Stones, which is also out of the ordinary for the series. And some of the designs and such sort of harken back to Shining Force, but also that whole monstrous presence is also...
Yeah, Sacred Stones takes a lot of cues from Fire Emblem Gaiden, the second Fire Emblem game, and that game was released, I would say, 1992-ish, so maybe that game is more harkened with Shining Force. I'm not sure when Shining Force actually started, but I would feel like they're all connected somehow
in
this.
On the Mega Drive, so maybe around the same time. I guess we have the power of the internet. I'll take a look.
Yeah, let's go do that. I'm going to go look at Gaiden.
It's only speculation that they're related, but...
I can double check. Yeah, Gaiden came out in 1992, so you can find out when Shining Force came out.
March 20th, 1992 in Japan, so...
Interesting, yeah.
Very, very close, then. Well, in Gaiden, was there a lot of monsters as well?
Yeah, a lot of monsters. I mean, it had a world map. Sacred Stone took a lot of adaptions from that. Sacred Stones is basically Fire Emblem Gaiden, but brought to that current gen. It's a lot better, because I have a lot of rants about Fire Emblem Gaiden, but I'm not going to put that on the podcast. As for the other game that I recall that I actually completed, I did complete Dragon Quest One. I've cleared my first Dragon Quest game. I've been roped in. I started a bit of Dragon Quest Two. That seems a lot more interesting, since it actually has a party system. But I can say, yeah, Dragon Quest, as I mentioned in the last podcast, it was very bare bones, as much as I expected. So, I can't say I was let down by it. That's what I came for. Just wanted to get a feel of what the series was about. And it was overall enjoyable. I can't say too much about it, because that's all it was. I beat the Dragon Lord. I got all the spells with my main character, and it was basically a battle of who can keep their HP up the most. So I'm looking forward to what they've adapted in Dragon Quest II. I know it's not going to be that much, because Dragon Quest has a history of not changing much, but I like the little new things they've added now, like how the main character doesn't get magic. That's all probably to the other party members. I'm not sure, since they only have one of them. The main character is more of just a melee attacker. And the world map looks a lot bigger in Dragon Quest II, so that is interesting to me. Much more places to explore. I expect to grind, because that's what the series is about. So, you know, as long as I expected, I guess I can't be too upset.
Did you fall to the Dragon Lord in Dragon Quest?
Yeah, I didn't want to see what the response was. It's not actually that interesting. You don't get, like, a dramatic game over screen or anything.
Did you have any trouble with the ultimate dickheads of that game? The Star Wyverns, which might have actually been called Cosmic Chimeras in the version you played.
I'm not sure what they were called. They probably some type of wyvern name. I don't recall off the top of my head. I was actually pretty on top of my equipment, so it wasn't too difficult.
They can be assholes, but anyways.
I don't know if things were changed a bit for balance-wise, since I was playing the Super Famicom remake, so maybe that could have been a thing.
Right.
I had far more trouble with the Dragon Lord, because if you do poorly in the first half of the battle, the second half of the battle is really going to destroy you, but that took me some time.
Yeah, with the Dragon Lord, because you don't want to get rid of all your spells at the first of it, because... it's sort of like attack heal kind of battle.
Right, yeah.
That's just because you've only got the one character, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then sometimes the Dragon Lord can heal himself. and that just makes the battle go on longer than it needs to be. It was really back and forth, but I made through it.
So you're on to Dragon Quest II. Are you going to play these games sequentially then?
I guess so. I was playing Dragon Quest I because Dragon Quest I and II are on the same cartridge, essentially, so I just naturally moved on to II. Three does look kind of interesting, though, but everyone's telling me how great Yang is in eight, so...
Well, if you want to play just for characters in eight's the way to go.
Yeah. Get some Puff there. I haven't encountered Puff Putt in Dragon Quest II. I'm waiting for it, though.
With bated breath, yeah.
There's another game that I beat quite some time ago, but for whatever reason I kept forgetting to bring it up. I did go back to Star Tropics 2, Zoda's Revenge, and clear that game. I took a break between the games, so I had to readjust myself to the jumping once again. And I have to say, I never got used to the jumping in that game. I got a bit better at it, but I was never really proficient enough at it. I would still fall into pits half the time, even though I felt like I could make it. And
any jumping onto a moving platform in Star Tropics 2 is always taking your life in your hands, so.
Yeah, I do appreciate that they really tried to improve the dungeons and made them more interesting and more dynamic, but with the jumping system, it was really irritating more than it needed to be.
Right.
And I do still feel that it wasn't as charming as the first game. It did have some moments, but I think the first game with its tropical setting and just the way it was laid out was more endearing and funny to me, but two was a little weirdly paced and just...
It's a bit railroady at times.
Yeah.
No, I tell you what, Star Tropics 2 gets a very bad rap. Like, there are some people that just can't stand it. I don't mind it. I definitely like the first game more. I definitely think the first game's a lot tighter. I can see why they made some of the decisions they made in Star Tropics 2. I don't necessarily agree with them. But it's definitely worth a play.
Oh yeah, I definitely think it was a decent game. Just I do prefer the first game more. Yeah. It definitely wasn't bad. It was just I wish jumping wasn't bad.
You can diagonal jump in that game, yes?
Yeah,
and with Star Tropics, the thing is, once you've started to move, you've committed to that movement. Like, you move from tile to tile to tile. In Star Tropics 2, I believe, you don't move one tile space, you move, like, gradually instead.
Kind of, yeah.
It does kind of throw off your jumping because it's not as exact. And I find that if you land on the edge of a moving platform, sometimes it'll count it as not landing on the platform at all. So that can be frustrating.
I made it, though. Although, I also remember that there was a boss rush at the end of the game, and that was not fun at all, either. No. I still made it, though, with perseverance.
Good.
Now, what are you doing on this leap day? I hope you are spending your time well with the Aggro cast.
Oh, yes. Nothing I want to do more on my leap day. My favorite day that comes once every 4 years. You know, instead of going to the town leap day feast, I'm spending it here on the Aerocast. I don't know. Don't know what I'm doing with myself. I really don't. No, it's been a...
Recording on a leap day is like a monumental time for the Aggrocast. I think we should celebrate it.
I'll have a feast.
Yeah, let's do that after the cast. Let's just have a feast.
No, it's been a good day, actually. This last week has been beautiful, to be honest. It's been really good. It's actually felt like spring. The air has smelled clean. I've been, breathing well. I guess it's not pollen times yet. I've been feeling good all month. It's been terrific. It's been fucking terrific. This winter is markedly different than the last two winters because there's been melt between the snowfalls. Like, we might get some snow within a few days as well. And, I mean, I'm not so bitter about that because there's barely any snow out there right now. Like, you get a reprieve between the snowstorms, it makes it a little bit more easy to stomach. I guess the winter just decided to let it go.
Every month, I just hope we don't do a Frozen reference, and here we are.
I've been waiting to do it. As for what I've been playing, I finally played through Brothers: A Tale of Two Sons, and I played it on the PlayStation 3, and I actually had this game on flash sales on Steam and on the PSN. For some reason, I guess I forgot that I had it on the Steam and got it on the PlayStation Network, but you know, overall,
yeah,
I
you
paid
can play
a
it twice.
The game, anyways. No, I don't think so. I'll eventually go back to see if the couple of trophies I missed because I go get them
Chivos.
Yeah, it was a lot darker than I expected to be. Like, I don't want to spoil it because it is an artsy feels journey kind of game about
our
two
favorite.
brothers, about two brothers that you control, one with the left stick and one with the right stick, and you know, kind of work together to make your way through the world, and you're looking for a certain flower to take back because your father's been in an accident, and you know your mom's already dead, so you want to save your dad because he's the only one you got left, kind of thing. And it's sort of a coming of age story for the brothers, and sort of overcoming adversity, and you know, looking beyond the nature of certain things. And it's a pretty good story. It's less typical than I thought it was going to be. And like, if you look at like previews of this game, it looks like it's just in like a fantasy world or a medieval world or whatever. That's just sort of idyllic, but it's actually got a lot of dark elements to it, like surprisingly dark at times. And I appreciated that more, since I guess I'm kind of ruining it on people now, but I appreciate it more because I didn't expect it. So I won't say anything more about that aspect of the game, but much more mature than I thought it was going to be, for sure.
I know of it. I've just been meaning to pick it up for ages, so maybe I should really look into it again.
You see it on the flash sale on the PSN. It's worth picking up. It's worth picking up.
Yeah. I may even have it already. I just forgot.
Maybe. That's what happened to me, so. I've like owned it twice for over a year, and I'm like, you know what? Let's just play through this tonight, and I did, and it was good, so. That was all good. The other game I played that took up most of the month was Ogre Battle, March of the Black Queen on the Super Nintendo, which the Ogre Battle series is my favorite strategy role-playing game series. And I got this game years ago now and played through, but I didn't get the best ending. So I went through and got the best ending, and really good to play through it again. For folks that don't know, Ogre Battle's a tactical role-playing game, but it's not turn-based like a lot of the tactical games that you folks might be used to, where it's real-time with the battles playing out automatically. You don't have any direct control over the battles. They're based on how you've managed your army. Like, it's a micromanagement game, and you can give them general tactics, but it's up to how you form your units and what classes make up the units, how they will operate in battle. So it's very satisfying to see your best laid plans come true. And, you know, game's got cool voice clips. It's got, you know, fairly decent dialogue, fairly decent story. Different hooks to the different maps. Like, most times liberating a city with a high alignment unit will raise your reputation. But there's certain maps where they're so engrossed with the Empire and they believe in the Empire so much that if you liberate those cities, that your reputation actually goes down because they don't want you there, kind of thing. So, lots of elements to the game. It's not difficult for a new player to pick up the game and beat it, but to pick it up and excel and get the best endings, you need to understand some of the underlying systems to it. So, there is a barrier of entry in terms of that. But if you just want to play through the game, I think it's easily accessible to anyone. It's just that if you want to have an ending that doesn't make you an evil prick, then you should learn some of the underlying systems as well.
Is the Ogre Battle series still ongoing? Or has it been on the longest hiatus for years?
The last Ogre Battle game was on the Neo Geo Pocket Color.
Oh, wow, geez, okay.
And Tactics Ogre just had a re-release a couple of years ago on the PSP.
Tactics Ogre was on the PlayStation 1, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the Super Famicom, and the Saturn, and so on and so
and
forth.
And everything else, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same as Ogre Battle was on the PlayStation and the Saturn as well.
Yeah, I've always had some interest in Ogre Battle. I remember there was an article in Nintendo Power about Ogre Battle 64, so good thing I didn't actually pick it up then, because 64 was apparently the worst one.
No, Ogre Battle 64 is fucking terrific.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe it was some other game that I'm mistaking it with.
Yeah, Ocarina of Time.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I could see some people complaining about Ogre Battle 64, but it's actually more complex than the SNES game because you have more spaces to fit units into, and like if a unit engages you from the side, then like you've got like 9 squares, and you can put people in the front, middle, or back, and if they attack you from the side, say the person that's in the front left and the back left are suddenly in the front because it has a facing system in Ogre Battle 64, and it has a lot more complexity to it. It's a very similar game, and it's a great game. It's unique on the N64 in that it is a long role-playing game that doesn't pull its punches and doesn't patronize the player. I can't speak for Aiden Chronicles of the First Mage, but Quest 64 is horseshit. And
maybe that was the one I'm mistaking with. Quest 64 is probably the garbage one.
Maybe. Yeah. There's only like 2 Ogre Battle games that you could play, well, besides the Gaiden game on the Neo Geo Pocket Color, Ogre Battle 64 and Ogre Battle. And there's also Tactics Ogre on the PlayStation. Tactics Ogre, Let Us Cling Together. And the other Tactics Ogre game is on the Game Boy Advance. That's Tactics Ogre Knight of Lotus, which was, even then, on the GBA, was hard as hell to get. I'd say if you want to give the games a try, Ogre Battle is very different from Tactics Ogre. Tactics Ogre is more similar to what most people out there would have played already. Ogre Battle's system, it might not be for everyone because it is quite different, but it's worth playing because it's different than what you're used to.
So the first one is on the Super Famicom, Super Nintendo?
Tactics Ogre?
Is that the first one, Tactics Ogre?
No, Ogre Battle came first.
Yeah, so that's on the Super Nintendo.
Yes.
Okay.
And they're all in the same series. And Ogre Battle, you know, bless them. They tried to do a Star Wars thing. Ogre Battle is Chapter 5. So, okay. You know. So, will the very first chapter be ever told? Probably not now.
Probably better than Xenogears being Episode 6.
Is it Episode 6?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could go into a whole discussion about Xenogears, but let's not do that for the cast. That would take a whole cast and then some.
Anyways, Ogre Battle, if you are listening to this podcast, I probably have a write-up on it, which I actually have written an entire article about it and just have to do the pictures for it, so hopefully that'll be up sometime.
Gotta get those cute pictures.
Yeah, I have to get my first princess I had in Ogre Battle, and the princesses are like the most powerful unit in the game, and the game gave me as a random loot 4 crowns, which is what you use to promote female units into princesses. So I was like, okay, just break me wide open is what the game said to me. But my first princess I promoted an Amazon named Rita, so I imagine it was like, you know, finally after 10,000 years I'm a princess. So, and she ended up being evil as sin by the end of it, so I was like, yeah, it's really good. So that was my flying death unit, Rita Repulsa and her Wyvern. So
could you rename characters? I would have renamed all my characters like Goldar and Zed.
You can only name the main character.
Oh, okay.
So I was happy to get like a character named Pizza and a character named Chips and a character.
You can personally rename them in your mind, Goldar.
I guess I could. Yeah. So, as for what I've been watching, without going into too much detail because of spoilers, because it's still relatively new, I saw The Hateful Eight, which I really enjoyed. If you've seen any Tarantino movie, you know what to expect. There's not many movies I can say should be 3 hours long, but The Hateful Eight uses its minutes very wisely, and there's a lot of like character development and character conflict and such throughout it. So, good show. Give it a watch. I also finished watching Making a Murderer, the Netflix documentary, since the last time we talked. And I don't want the podcast to be too political, so I'm not going to comment on it. Other than that, it's a provocative series. Obviously, not all of the information is conveyed in it, but enough is conveyed that you might think, yeah, this is a bit fucky. It's a provocative series, and it's definitely worth watching. The other thing, I've been watching Mad Men for a couple months now and finished up early in February. That was a good show. It's one of the shows that people are like, oh, you got to watch this. And yeah, it was good. It was good. It was different, but it was good. Kind of most of the characters in it are pretty... despicable is not the word, but like very gray, dark gray morality. And you're kind of like, these people are slimeballs. And you don't really root for anyone, but you're very interested in their character arcs. And some people kind of turn it around by the end of it, and some people don't. It's a very scathing look at the consumer mentality of the 60s and the glass ceiling and advertising business. It's fairly scathing, and I don't know if a lot of people picked up on how critical it is, but it's fairly critical. But that's a good show, too. So, all the shows I mentioned, I don't want to talk too much about them because I don't really want to spoil any of them. It's hard to spoil like Mad Men now because so many people have seen it. But yeah, I don't really want to spoil any of them, but they're all decent watches. Chris, before we move on to the roguelike section, there were a couple of game anniversaries this month, a couple of them that are quite stories. But the one that we can talk about just briefly is the 30th anniversary of The Legend of Zelda, the Hyrule Fantasy, on the Famicom disk system in Japan. And I don't know, did you have any comments about The Legend of Zelda to make? Or did you do anything for the 30th anniversary of The Legend of Zelda? Any comments about, you know, Spirit Tracks?
Well, it was probably because you were on Twitter talking about how good Aquamentos is. I decided to pull up my Swordless Link file. It's on the 3DS, so you can kind of just close it and then come back to it whenever. So the problem with that is I have no recollection of what exactly I was doing at that point. Right. I think I'm at the third Triforce, but which dungeon does it mean in Swordless?
Yeah, I'd have to look at my notes.
Exactly. I would have to catch up on what I was doing. I got some rupees so I could use my bow and arrow because, you know, the invisible rupee arrow carrier or whatever you called him.
Yeah.
So what I think stuff? I was trying to get rupees to power my bow and arrow, but I don't really recall what I was doing. But you know what I thought about Zelda, so happy 30th anniversary, Zelda.
Right, and I played through just a bog standard Legend of Zelda first quest. That took me less than half, I was going to say less than half an hour. It took me less than an afternoon, so it was fun to play through. I played the FDS version for that music. I still enjoy playing The Legend of Zelda, and we talked at length about this game not that long ago, so I don't want to labor the point, but yes, I'm glad that the series, it's a love-hate series, I guess, for me, but happy 30th, because yeah, I still love The Legend of Zelda.
I think it's best that we avoid ranting about newer things. Let's just focus on the original game and how much we love it, and it's great.
As I mentioned at the top of the show, we are going to talk about roguelike games today. Now, roguelike games are games that resemble the game Rogue. Rogue is a dungeon crawling. I know.
Sorry, just the way you set that up is so amusing.
Rogue is a dungeon crawling video game first developed by Michael Toy and Glenn Wichman around 1980. Now, the term roguelike is actually a point of contention with disagreement as to what it actually means. For instance, when I was in the or at least lurking the Izuna, the Unemployed Ninja for Nintendo DS boards on GameFAQs. There are a lot of people saying that like roguelike is a buzzword or WTF is a roguelike. It's similar to shmups in that regard, as people are like, hey, what are you going to call it this? What are you going to call it this? And, right. So, yes, there is disagreement as to what it actually means and when it is appropriate to use it. What we can agree on, however, is that they are a prevailing category of games. They've been around since the 80s, and they're not stopping. There's lots that are in active development that have been around for years and years. They just don't stop. And the other thing that we might agree on is that roguelike elements have become very prevalent and desirable in many titles, especially within the independent gaming scene. So I do have a set of qualities that have been agreed upon by the International Roguelike Development Conference that define a roguelike. However, before I actually go through that list of things, how would you describe roguelikes yourself? Like, what is a roguelike?
For me, I would say the basic definition is a randomized dungeon, and I usually get my ass kicked a lot. There's generally like an RPG kind of system where you have equipments, there's spells to learn, but I feel like the main focus is a dungeon that is randomized that you have to traverse.
Right, so a randomly generated dungeon. So, folks, this is a bit of a read, so I'm sorry if I miss any important details. I do suggest that if you're interested in roguelikes, you do read this yourself, just to pick up on all the details. This is called the Berlin Interpretation, and it's a set of factors to use to define what a roguelike is. Now, as I mentioned, they were defined at the International Roguelike Development Conference in 2008, held in Berlin, Germany. That's why it's called the Berlin Interpretation.
I want to say I'm impressed this existed. I don't find it hilarious. I just find it very amusing and very impressed that
there's a lot of roguelikes.
Commitment happened, yeah.
There's a lot of roguelikes in development, so you know, even the one that we talk about all the time, Crawlstone Soup, you know, always has an in development trunk game that you can play and test on their site. And so these are the factors that they came to agree on. Now, these games procedurally generate random levels, monsters, and treasure. These levels are tile-based and may be persistent, like some roguelikes have like towns that are always the same, or the first level of certain roguelikes is always the same. Generally, they're depicted in ASCII. That's not always the case, of course. There's lots of graphical roguelikes. Now, these games employ a permadeath system, typically. Gameplay is turn-based, with actions of players and monsters taking up a certain amount of units of time, like in-game time. So time does not progress if you do not provide an action. So at the simplest execution of this idea, for example, in Izuna, every action that the enemy in Izuna takes are basically use the same amount of time units, and the enemies won't move until you move, and then at that point, their actions all activate simultaneously, right? This is also true in like Stone Soup, except your actions, I think the time units they use is AUTS, OTS. So once you do an action, every other enemy begins their action and they follow through on those. Now, gameplay is heavily focused on a hack and slash system. However, these games provide multiple interacting systems that might provide varying solutions to any given situation. Item identification is unique to any one session. So, for instance, if you find a bubbling potion in one game and identify it, it might be a potion of curing. But if you identify it in the next session, it might be a potion of poison. So, even though they might have the same description, they might actually have a different use, which forces the player to have to consider the effects and potential danger of every new item they find in every new session. Players must manage limited resources such as potions, food, and so on, and the games are often a single-player experience. Now, these are fairly restrictive, traditional roguelike qualities, and any one game that someone describes as a roguelike, it might be missing one of these. For instance, Toe Jam and Earl has procedurally generated levels that have, you know, randomly generated monsters on each, well, randomly generated humans from a pool of humans on each one, and the presents are different every time you play, but obviously it doesn't have a turn-based system, for instance, and you have multiple lives rather than just the one life. So there's things like that. Like, people call Toe Jam and Earl a roguelike, and it is explicitly stated by the developers that it was inspired by Rogue. So it's basically a roguelike, and
that's where the
points of contention come in. That's where the points of contention come in. Is there anything you think is too restrictive about the descriptions here, or do you think that the term can be expanded?
I feel like it covers most of the basics of what I would think about a roguelike, so I think right. The definition covers pretty much the gist of it. I think it's actually a fairly good definition.
Right, and it's a long definition, but for a traditional roguelike, I think it fits. The other term a lot of people use are roguelites, but also roguelike-like, which I think is getting
a little too ridiculous, yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit ridiculous. But what do you think that roguelites are a thing? Like, you think that's an apt description, or should you consider the games that people call roguelites, roguelikes?
I guess since I agree with the Berlin definition, I think a roguelite is something that sort of has some of those elements, but is missing also a fair bit of that definition. So I think roguelite does work. At the point of roguelike light, I think that's getting a bit too far now.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't even know how to define anything at that point.
I like to call these, like, I like to call these games just, you know, such and such a game, platforming game with roguelike elements, or a roguelike platformer or something like that. And people will generally understand that it usually means, well, for these kind of games, the modern games, the big draw is the random dungeon or the procedurally generated levels. Like, that's where the term roguelike often comes into use when talking about, like, a modern platforming game that has, like, random loot or the random dungeon. That seems to be the big focus.
Right.
Let's dial it back a little. How were you first introduced to roguelikes?
Considering how vague this description actually is, I mean, how many different varieties there are of roguelikes, even though we just covered it. Now it's really difficult to say, because I can't say, was it Mystery Dungeon that properly introduced me, or was it Spelunky that properly introduced me? I kind of got into the roguelikes and roguelites sort of at the same time, so everything kind of blends in. Right. But again, it's really difficult to say now, because there's probably games I played beforehand that were randomly preceded that I just didn't realize were roguelikes.
So you say that the first time you were aware of roguelike being a thing was
probably Mystery Dungeon, yeah.
Probably Mystery Dungeon, right. And I know you've played a lot of games from around the same time, because you've talked about, I don't know if you talked about it on the podcast, but you mentioned Zork every once in a while and things like that, so I know you've played games from that
era. The good old text adventures, yeah.
Which are just as deadly as roguelikes, but I know you've played games from the era. It's just that roguelikes might not have come up. As for myself, I'm going to talk about it at depth later, but the first roguelike I would have played is Castle of the Winds back on the PC. And I'll talk about that in depth later. It's a pretty light roguelike, but it's not a roguelite. But we'll come back to that.
It's such a wild definition.
Great. So while we're still just on the formative phase of talking about roguelikes, we've talked about what roguelike elements are: the procedural generation, sometimes permadeath, sometimes randomized items and monsters. Are these desirable to have in games, and, you know, what makes them compelling, and, like, when are they appropriate?
I definitely find, because of the random generated dungeons, I think having elements such as the class system and if you can learn magic or not. I think that kind of just adds to the random and anything can happen sort of sense that roguelikes offer. So I think that really adds to the appeal of them. Just, there are different ways to get to the end point of this already randomized dungeon. You can make your own experience randomized in a way to add to it.
So you believe that this makes the experience a bit more unique and personal to the player, then?
Yeah, I definitely think so, because, like, in Crawl, which we're gonna get more in-depth to, like, I definitely like playing as the magic character, because not only because I'm determined because of this character, but I just find magic to be a far more interesting system than just doing melees.
Right. Right. So, these roguelike elements, so, for instance, let's talk about the random procedurally generated dungeons. Does this make the game compelling? You say it makes each experience more unique, so do you ever find that exhaustive about games where, like, you might have had a really good run in Crawl, but then the next time you go to the dungeon on a new character, it's completely different. Does that sometimes act as a detractor, or does that make it more compelling to actually see what's changed and what's new?
I think for our personalities that apparently like challenge, this is not detracting at all. I think it just makes it more interesting and more determined to try stuff out. Of course, like, sometimes I will fire up the game and then I get murdered on the first floor 5 steps in, but it's still that one more game kind of attitude that just happens from it, because there can be a run where you do a lot better, so there's always that possibility.
Which also factors into the difficulty in the permadeath. Now, I know permadeath is probably on your mind because every other tweet I see on Twitter is about whether permadeath in Fire Emblem is bad or good. How do you feel about permadeath as a gameplay mechanic, and especially in terms of a roguelike? Because let me remind people, although roguelikes are a fairly straight run to the bottom usually, like even Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup will take hours to beat. So permanently losing your character after hours and hours, that can be painful. Again, what do you think of permadeath as a gameplay mechanic?
It is really painful when you spend hours and hours and your character dies, but if you do make it, it is really rewarding, and that is what I'm into. I am into the ultimate reward at the end.
Right.
There's less permadeath in Etrian Mystery Dungeon, which I felt kind of detracted from the game's difficulty. It was really forgiving. It wasn't actually permadeath. So I feel like that kind of took away from the appeal of just the permadeath and how much everything you do counts.
Right. So, like, that era of roguelikes, going back to Izuna, there was no permadeath in Izuna. You basically sort of lost your progress from that dungeon. There's multiple dungeons in it. However, when you beat Izuna, you get a 100 floor dungeon that does have, if you lose, you lose everything and you start from level 1 when you start this dungeon. So, didn't you say that Etrian had a similar kind of system?
Yeah, it sort of does. If your party, well, it has a party system for one thing, which is a lot different than most roguelikes where you're just one character.
Right.
But because of the party system, it made it so that you have technically 4 chances to survive a dungeon. And then even if your party gets wiped, you're only really punished by having your equipment taken away from you and your gold. But the game also has a storage system, which doesn't make it as terrible. I mean, you could lose, like, your best sword, but you might have a backup. So it's not really detrimental.
The other sometimes controversial system in roguelikes is, like, when a game has a hunger or thirst system. People sometimes don't quite like that, to be blunt. And actually, there's talk in Crawl, a lot of people are trying to push to get rid of the food system altogether in Crawl, which I don't know what kind of repercussions that would have, or since magic and prayer abilities often have a hunger cost. How do you think about having to manage resources on top of everything else a roguelike throws at you?
I think it depends on the game. In Mystery Dungeon, I think it's fitting in a way, just because it's very, very strict on turns and monsters move when you move. kind of thing. It's very one step at a time. It seems more restrictive than Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup, where I'm starting to think, does the hunger system actually matter in Stone Soup that much now that you brought it up?
I got like 30 steaks by the end of it. I'm usually set, but...
Yeah, that's kind of the thing about Stone Soup. You do get a lot of food in comparison to like Mystery Dungeon, where I'm a little bit more limited on food.
If you're a troll in Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup, you have a very high metabolism and you get hungry very, very quick. Like, super quick. But you can eat, you can overeat, and you can eat, flesh that's sort of off and things like that, and you can basically get engorged. Basically get engorged just by eating flesh. But if you're a Spriggan, you can't eat any meat. And even though you have a very low metabolism and it takes you a long time to get hungry, if you're a Spriggan caster, you're actually using hunger and burning hunger to cast your spells. So, you know, better get a lot of fruit and bread, because you're not going to be eating any of those chunks of flesh on the ground. It means more for other characters than it does for some.
Yeah, definitely, because now that I think about it, in Mr. Dungeon, there have been plenty of times where I've run out of food, and I am taking one step and losing one HP, and I'm trying to get out of the dungeon. But I guess based on how I've been playing Stone Soup, I haven't had an issue where I've been starving and out of food.
Since they buffed Hungry Ghosts, and they've buffed another enemy later that now causes severe hunger loss for some reason, it's become a bit more of a problem when you're near starving and passing out. But yeah, if you play your cards right in Stone Soup, it shouldn't be a problem. But what do I think about roguelike elements being desirable in games? I do believe that, yes, they are desirable, because I like to see what is going to happen next time. Like, Rogue Legacy has an option that if you pay the architect half of the gold you earn on your next run, he will lock down the castle and it'll be exactly the same as it was before. And I only used that when I had to do the, like, beat the game in less than 12 characters trophy or something like that. I might have used it once for that because I knew where some chests were that I wanted to get. But largely, I don't mind going in, seeing something completely new, and just, you know, groping your way through the early bit, and then once you're established and know how to play a roguelike, the new different layouts, they don't matter as much because you can adjust to them. The real question I want to ask is, take a Legend of Zelda or a Final Fantasy or whatever, and suddenly, do these become appropriate? Are they always appropriate just because they're good, or do you think that roguelike elements have to be with a specific kind of game?
Yeah, with a game like Zelda, I think maybe you could start moving things around. You can't have randomly created dungeons, which might be interesting, but knowing Zelda, they probably won't do that. But I think certain elements could certainly work for certain games. It's definitely a pick-and-choose situation.
Right.
I wouldn't mind seeing that, because such elements make the game more interesting and unique, but we'll have to see. It's kind of a we'll-have-to-see kind of thing.
They're often relegated to, like, bonus areas or something like that that have a different kind of mechanic. Of course, Final Fantasy XIII also had that. Of course, Final Fantasy X, too. I don't know how I mixed those up. Also has that spin-off roguelike game for some reason that I played through. But yeah, I think there's an appropriate time for these elements, and I think there's room for everything. Now, we've talked sort of about what roguelikes are, or what we are going to say they are, but going back to the big name, roguelikes, have you played any of the big traditional roguelikes like Crawl or Adom or NetHack or even Rogue?
I've never touched Rogue, and obviously Crawl is my number one roguelike game. Played a bit of Adom, and I played a bit of NetHack a while ago, but it's been a while, so I can't really talk about it, but I can try to pull some of my memories.
What was your first impressions of Adom, Ancient Domains of Mystery?
Well, first, I'm going to admit that I tried the graphical version, and those graphics look really cheesy. So I immediately backtracked and got the HD2 version.
I didn't even know there was a graphical Adom.
Yeah, I wasn't that impressed. Like, I like Crawl as a tiles base instead of the HD2, but yeah, Adom, I just immediately went back to HD2 and felt it more appropriate.
Right. Right.
The genuine experience with the AC2s, but Adom, I think I only covered really the tutorial, and I did like a basic run with a paladin. It didn't go very far, but I just wanted to get the scope of Adom since I had not touched it until we were going to talk about roguelikes for this cast.
Yeah, Adom's one of the big ones, and it's one of the most popular ones, and it is really well done. The thing that might throw some people off about Adom is that it's very sprawling. Like, it's not unusual for a roguelike to have a couple of dungeons, but, like, Adom has a world map and multiple dungeons, and
it has side quests and stuff, big and sprawling.
It has specific quests, and has a lot of different classes and backgrounds. You can be, a dragon kind of guy, too, and you can be a hearthling instead of a halfling, and things like that. So Adom's a really solid game, and I think that for a lot of folks that are starting with roguelikes, Adom is fairly, it's not super newbie friendly, but it's got enough support documents and it's intuitive enough that if you give it some time, then it's definitely a great game to play. I don't think any roguelikes are very newbie friendly except for like Castle of the Winds, which I'll talk about again shortly, but Adom's a good one. Crawl is another one that I would recommend playing if you're starting out, because again, we've talked about this a lot, but Crawl is a much more focused game than Adom. It's one dungeon with multiple branches, but everything sort of coalesces on finding the Orb of Zot. In that sense, Crawl is a very much a traditional roguelike of get the item of power and then escape the dungeon. Do you have anything you want to say specifically about Dungeon Crawl, Stone Soup, because I know that you've played this one a fair bit now.
Yeah. Adom, I can see it being expansive. As I said, I only played most of the tutorial, which I do think actually covers a lot of what you need as a newbie, and the manual is right there. It's accessible if you needed to look back on any commands or anything. Yep. So, Adom does just build you up really well, but Crawl, I think, is more simplistic in a way, and for some reason, I appreciate that. So, for Crawl, I think, well, suppose because I'm biased, because Crawl is the one I'm really attached to. But, yeah, I think Crawl just being focused on the one dungeon is pretty appealing to me. Maybe once I actually beat Crawl, I can move on to bigger things like Adom.
Yeah, I'd like to actually beat or make serious progress in Adom now that I've done a few successful runs of Crawl. Crawl, we're playing the variant Dungeon Crawl, Stone Soup. Like, that's what's being developed for Crawl right now. It's a game with a lot of history, and this is just the development path that this particular variant has gone down. It's got a lot of quality of life advancements in it. Like, you play Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup 2 versions ago, it'll be a completely different experience than if you play it now. And it's been made a bit more user-friendly in some respects, and then less in others. Like, I don't know if the version you play still categorizes meat chunks as each different monster, like chunks of bear flesh or chunks of kobold flesh.
No, mine doesn't. I have 0.17, I think.
Oh my goodness. 0.1. Oh my goodness. When they decided that we're going to stack flesh, that was amazing to me. I was like, oh, I'm going to have all this inventory space. I don't have all this inventory space. I fill it up with other tack, but that was great.
Do you play Trunk updates, or do you only play the big releases?
I try Trunk sometimes, but I haven't played the 0.18 Trunk. I generally stick to my own client on my own computer. I don't really play online.
Right, yeah.
Maybe I should, because then I'd be getting Demchivos or whatever. I think there is actually a couple of, like, you are awesome kind of things that you get if you beat the game with every kind of class and every kind of background.
I don't even actually play online, so I'm too ashamed that someone will see me die constantly.
I mean, it's a roguelike. That's what happens.
I know.
And in general, Stone Soup community seems alright.
I haven't really focused on the community, but I mean, they seem to be really
like the next version of Crawl, you might not have resist mutation at all, and you like there's different changes like that, and that's a big thing in Crawl. I don't think you've gotten deep enough to actually face enemies that can malmutate you, but getting a bad mutation in Crawl can be disastrous.
I've gotten far enough where I got mutated into a pig once, and I was like, this is great, thanks a lot.
You're polymorphed by Cersei now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Crawl is very newbie-friendly, and I think it does well because it has a lot of different kind of classes. Like, you can be a stabby class, like a stealthy stabby class, or you can be a bruiser of a melee class, or you can cast some serious fucking shit. Like, it has options. It has options. You'll never find a Naga birding or a Centaur birding, so use those classes at your, you know, at your own peril, but, you know.
You know, you say them, and I run into them all the time as a Tengu.
You will never find them as a Naga.
Exactly.
And they're too slow that they'll never get a dungeon one anyway. Anyhow. So, what do you think of the uniques in Dungeon Crawl? Song Soup, like the unique monsters you fight?
Well, I haven't gotten far enough, but I do like the variety. I don't feel like there's been, like, really obvious palette swaps kind of feelings. I feel like each monster has been sort of a different approach most of the time.
Yeah. Sigmund is a bit of an asshole. And...
Yeah, and definitely the uniques are really... They all have something different that makes me either go, great, well, or, all right, I can take you on.
Even Grindr doesn't have, like, a typical shadow imp sprite. But I think it's the uniques are very, very frequent in Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup. There are some roguelikes that you fight a unique and you are dead in the water if you find these fuckers. But with Stone Soup, generally, one of the main benefits of its design is that you've got a lot of panic buttons in that game and a lot of ways to run away. Like, if you are fighting something that's completely out of your depth, then you can GTFO, and that's the best course of action. I think it's the mentality that you have to save all your items that makes people not use, like, a scroll of blinking or a scroll of teleport. But it's often better to run away in Stone Soup than it is to actually fight.
Yeah, I mean, scrolls I feel like you can definitely get away with using in Stone Soup. Potions I'm a little more restrictive on, but when I'm really low on HP, that potion of curing better get in.
Yeah, well, potions of curing aren't really for health. They're for,
or like status effects, poison. Yeah.
And they don't really heal a lot, but if in a pinch, it can be good. Because I've escaped from battle and then died of poison and things like that, you know, so. So Stone Soup, I would agree that it's very user-friendly and very newbie-friendly, and it has an extended end game, so you can beat it with the three runes that you get, probably two from layer branches and maybe from the vaults or from the abyss. But if you want to get 15 runes, it's an entirely different story. Like, not all characters or classes are cut out for it, just because of the nature of the places you have to go and their unique effects, but if you're an experienced player at the game and you want to bring it to that next level, it's there for you as well. So I like that it has very clearly defined options for you to do after you've beaten the game a couple times the standard way. It's a good game. It's a very good game.
I can't stop playing it, even though I keep dying.
gotta worship that Vehumet and get a couple of books of conjuration.
Yeah. sometimes I don't even get Vehemoth, then I have to go for Sifmuna, and sometimes I don't even find Sifmuna, and I'm just like, oh great, who's the next person I can use?
No, I think there's a couple of deities that you could worship that are good. And I should mention again that Kral has a terrific piety system in it. Like, a lot of these roguelikes have a pantheon, but the pantheon in Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup is actually really good and, like, really fun. So you can define an entire character based on who you worship, or you can be, you know, a demigod and not worship anyone. Just, like, man, I'm a demigod. So there's lots of options in Stone Soup. Now, we talked a lot about Stone Soup. I'd say the other one that we've been playing and you want to talk about is Crypt of the Necrodancer. Would you say that Crypt of the Necrodancer qualifies as a traditional roguelike?
Well, it definitely works on a tile-based system and the random dungeons are there.
Right.
So, heck yeah, I would. Also, I mean, it does that unique twist of being rhythm-based, which I didn't think would be my thing, but that's the game I played extensively throughout February.
Right. And someone might say, oh, but Crypt of Necrodancer isn't turn-based, but it technically is, because every beat is a turn, and if you don't move on that turn, it's the same as, okay, I press the period button and crawl and skip my turn. So, yeah, it is turn-based, and it's definitely, I mean, I would consider it as a traditional roguelike that has made a lot of concessions to accommodate the rhythm-based gameplay.
Right.
Tell us a bit about Crypt of Necrodancer. We've talked about it before, but this is on the record now. Tell us a little bit about Crypt of Necrodancer.
I've only been focusing on the main character, Candace. She has to move to the beat. Each floor has a different beat system. They get more complicated as you go through the four different zones, but I'm only on zone 3, so zone 4 could blast for me. But, I mean, there are other different characters. There's, like, a bard who doesn't move to the beat. There's also the monk who you're not allowed to collect any gold.
Let me just say that monk is fucking difficult to beat the game with. You don't realize how difficult it is. You say, oh, I just won't pick up any gold, but
easier said than done.
Yeah, easier said than done. And what it does is, every enemy now, if it never dropped gold before, it'll drop one gold now. So, like, if you, I don't know if you, did you fight Deep Blues?
I don't think I have.
Okay, but, like, did you fight King Conga?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, well, all those zombies in the Conga line
will now drop one gold.
Will now drop gold, so you might have to have a bomb to blow that gold up in order to get to the exit, right? So,
yeah, gold doesn't vanish over time. You've got to collect it or blow it up.
Monk is very difficult.
Yeah, I haven't even tried it. I just know the monk exists. And I'm just like, oh, that looks like a blast.
It's fun. It is really difficult.
Yes.
But go on.
But yeah, Candace, you know, she has basic abilities. She can collect randomly she can collect random weapons that appear. They may be unlocked by the diamond system. You collect diamonds throughout your explorations and you can buy new weapons. So it's going to be a constantly changing weapon thing for you. I mean, I think we have a new update where you can limit what items show up now. But overall, it's still pretty much random. Equipment is also random. Monsters also move to certain patterns that you need to get used to, all based on the beat. And since I think buying things is really important, you have to really keep in touch with the beat of the game to keep your multiplier up.
Yeah.
And not lose it. So there's a lot going on with the rhythm-based element, and still be a roguelike with its permadeath, and, well, it's not really as strict with permadeath, because there's, like, a shop system in the hub world, so you can come back and get some things, or get some sort of advantage, but overall, it does have a lot of those elements.
It does have a traditional play all four zones in a row mode, though.
Yeah, I haven't really touched that yet, because I can't even get through zone 4, so.
Have you reached zone 4?
No, the farthest I've gotten was Zone 3, Level 3. I don't think I got to the boss, or if I did, I died to the boss anyway. Which is also random, by the way.
Yeah. Zone 3 is a mess because it's so open. It's so open, and it also has two different songs, technically, so trying to keep in tune with that can be a bit difficult as you're switching behind. But as soon as you start Zone 3 and you see that everything is kind of moving in towards you, it's like, ah, shit.
Yeah. Shit. There's been plenty of times where I fire up a level and 3 gold skeletons and horses are already after me.
Are you still buying new upgrades then, or?
I think I've collected most of it. If not, like, maybe there's like 1 or 2 weapons left that I haven't gotten yet, but I think I pretty much have everything now at this point.
Do you have the shop that lets you buy things before you go into the dungeon?
Yeah, I unlocked that. That took me so long to unlock because I have a tendency to get hit. That involved carrying a glass key and I pretty much was a master at Zone 2. I could pretty much clear out a lot of things, but then I just get hit once and that glass key is gone, so I have to redo it all over again.
Yeah,
that's just the nature of roguelikes.
It's easy to get hit in that game, and once you do, like, once you lose your groove, you can get hit a lot because you kind of panic a bit. The character area, she cannot miss a beat or she will die. So the characters that I haven't done the character that move that everything is at double speed. And I haven't done the character that you can't miss a beat with. And then there's a character that combines the monk, the double speed, and not missing a beat, which I think like 12 people have beaten. So that's not really in the cards for me, I don't think.
You can be the 13th person, Matt.
I can be the 13th. No, I can. I think I can beat Area, and I think I can beat Bulk, but, like, I don't know if I'm at my limit or if I'm at a point where I'm content with what I've done with the game, because when I went back to Crypt, I played the hell out of it. So I'm taking an extended break from it, and I think when I go back, I'll be so out of practice that I don't know if I'll be able to get it back, but I'm content with what I've done with this. Technically, I haven't seen the full story because I haven't beaten Areas mode. Maybe I'll do that. I don't know what I'll do there, but it's interesting that, and it's also cool. You know, it's interesting that in the Crypt, you can beat it with Cadence, and I mean, that's still, you got your money's worth out of the game, but then there's all these other characters and all this stuff to unlock. So the game, you can play it pretty quickly and still enjoy it, or you can devote, like, lots and lots of time to it. Like, devote as much time to Necrodancer as people devote to a fighting game. And I don't know if I have it in me to devote that much time to one game. That's kind of why I don't play fighting games, is because I just, not that I don't like them, but I don't want to make that commitment. And that might be the case with Necrodancer, but it's definitely a game I'll be coming back to again and again, and I'll still try these characters, but I don't know how intense I'll be about it, because I might have hit my stride with that, or hit my wall with it. You know, who knows? We'll see what the months bring, I guess.
Yes, for me, I can't really say anything until I actually beat Candace's mode. I already feel like I'm not too hot at rhythm-based games, so if I can even make it to the end, do I feel like trying this again with a different character?
I'm not that great at rhythm games, but I still like Parappa the Rapper and Guitaro Man and things like that. There's still so much flavor and fun to them that it's like, you know, you gotta give them a shot even if you suck at them, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
At the height of what I was playing there, I knew the songs pretty well, and there's only a few things I would lose my multiplier against certain bosses and such to have, like, false notes and things. It's very fun and very creative, and I mean, I can't recommend Crypt of Necrodancer enough. It's excellent.
So good. I really like it a lot, too.
Now, we were talking a little bit about roguelites and about Spelunky. Just to talk about how roguelike elements enter into Spelunky and roguelites in general, give us a little bit of rundown of this game. I know we could do a whole podcast on Spelunky, but just give us a bit of...
Oh, boy, we could. Well, Spelunky is more platformer-based, but it does have the rogue-like elements of being randomly created dungeons. The loot is scattered randomly each time. what happens in the shops will be completely random. That, or even, like, there's certain different branching paths that will happen. Like, there's... Will you ever unlock the City of Gold one day? I have no idea. I mean, you need certain items for that to unlock it, and sometimes getting that all together in one run is a bit frustrating. But I would say that's pretty much the bulk of Spelunky, is just platforming and the random dungeons that one day I'll need to get past.
Yeah. It's a fairly brutal game at first, but once you start to pick up how to move in it and you know, how traps work and how enemies work, it becomes much more... Much more doable, and you can get through it pretty quick. You can do a speed Lunky run. Like, Spelunky is a really great game. I didn't play a whole lot of the original, but I mean, obviously, I played a lot of the HD release of it. Spelunky, it's sort of in the same category there as like Binding of Isaac. It's one of those games that kind of brought this whole roguelike elements in a different kind of game. Or a different kind of genre other than role-playing game, like, really into popular view. Like, people love The Binding of Isaac, and people love Spelunky. So, yeah, there's, they're pretty responsible for, and I'm not going to say solely responsible, but they're quite responsible for sort of this whole roguelike revelation. Like, if you go on Kickstarter, say, okay, this has roguelike dungeons, or if you go on Steam, this game has roguelike features. Like, it's more a buzzword than ever now, but I don't see that as necessarily a bad thing. You know, people like it, and it sells, I guess. As for Spelunky, did you ever play multiplayer Spelunky?
No, I haven't had a chance to.
It is a fucking mess. It's a mess. It's seriously a mess. But
it's already a mess with me playing single player, because I can't, like, clear the game yet. I just gotta yell about that jungle. The jungle's the worst section.
Oh, the jungle is the worst. The jungle's definitely the worst. Like, you could take ages in the jungle, but then just take, like, 5 minutes to get through the ice caves. And it smells like wet fur in there. It's the best song.
That is a really good song.
Yeah, if you
the jungle
chance...
is just bad in general, but sometimes I've gotten, like, the dark levels on the ice caves, and that is just the worst. Lots of bad things can happen, Spelunky.
That can be tough, yeah. But if you get the chance to play a multiplayer, it's an experience. Now, I don't want to dwell too long on these. They're all good games, but we just want to talk about some of our personal history with roguelikes. I know you mentioned that the Mystery Dungeon games were probably your first. You want to tell us, like, which Mystery Dungeon game got you into it, and sort of about your feelings and your feels about these Mystery Dungeon games.
Yeah, we've definitely covered this throughout, like, the months, because I got into them fairly recently in the spectrum of things. But I had played Pokemon Mystery Dungeon in the past, and because I have no recollection of it, I guess they were either not that good or they weren't appealing to me at the time. But what probably got me into it is when I just randomly, for some reason, felt like Tornico's Mystery Dungeon. And that was pretty much my introduction to the Mystery Dungeon series. It was pretty much the first Mystery Dungeon game where I learned about permadeath and being level one and hoping you get good equipment, but that doesn't happen all the time. Just random dungeons and dealing with the starvation system. Like, console roguelikes are definitely more simplistic than, you know, the old ones like Adom and NetHack. So... I think it was a good newcomer's way for me to get into roguelikes through Mystery Dungeon.
Right.
And then there was also stuff like Etrian Mystery Dungeon, which I briefly just talked about with the party system. And it's more built upon that. It's kind of more of a Mystery Dungeon, but it has the Etrian Odyssey elements to it. Different characters with classes, so there's that. And they all have their different skill systems. But then that kind of just makes the game a lot easier than it needs to be. And I've also touched on Shiren the Wanderer, playing one on the DS still, which is a remake of the first Shiren the Wanderer that was on the Super Nintendo. Tornico being my first Mystery Dungeon, I was more accustomed to dungeons being more more room-based, where they were actually rectangles. But since Sheeran is more of an outside game, I thought it was very fascinating that, like, the stages were more organic-looking. They weren't very strict to rectangular square shapes. They were more randomized in ways that they were just more jagged.
You're saying it was outside, you mean it's just that they still have like rooms but in an outside environment, but they're just differently shaped, or was it actually like wide open?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely like sometimes you get huge rooms, but they're more distinctively shaped. There are some caves where you get the more generic, like, oh, here's a hallway and here's a rectangle and here's another hallway connected to another rectangle kind of system, but for me, seeing, like, a more organic shape was interesting to me just because I was so used to, like, here are the four corners that I have to explore, and then there's the staircase.
I think the roguelikes might be reluctant to change from that sort of rectangle system because, of course, going into the hallway to make choke points and bottlenecks for enemies is, like, the strategy in a roguelike game. If it sort of subverts that a bit, that's interesting.
Yeah, and Mystery Dungeons also are more forgiving than also, like, older games where they do have a storage system where you can save items for another run. Of course, if you lose those items in a run, they're gone forever. But if you happen to come out of a dungeon with a really good sword, you can just store that away, and then if you feel that this run is the one, you can take it out.
Which Mystery Dungeon would you say is a good jumping-off point?
Probably Sheeran the Wanderer. I would definitely say that. Right. Tornico, I think, is too basic. I mean, it was a good introduction for me, but I feel like it just doesn't really have enough appeal, kind of. It's kind of like when me playing Dragon Quest. It was very bare bones, so it gave me the introduction, but there's not really flavor to it. I think Sheeran also has more interesting elements to it, just because you go to different villages and there's NPCs to talk to and there's side quests. So it's more robust than the first Tornico.
Good, good. Is that all you want to say about Mystery Dungeons? Or?
Well, I mean, I don't know how the other Tornico games have adapted, because I know there was a Tornico 2 and then there was a Tornico The Last Hope on the PlayStation 1. So I don't know, since they were mostly kind of started to develop at the same time, I don't know how many elements have taken from one another.
Right. So, I know you don't want to talk in depth about it, but since you actually probably have more experience with it than I do, any comments about Dwarf Fortress?
Dwarf Fortress. Apparently, it's categorized as a roguelike. I always like to comment it as a suffering simulator, because it's not exactly newbie-friendly, because there is so much to learn about Dwarf Fortress beforehand. You can learn some things while playing it, but most of it you need to know beforehand. And is there a point in the game, I guess, surviving, really? I mean, the point of the game, as described by the creators, is that it's to have fun, in quotation marks. So, it's definitely a game of endurance. So many different things can happen. I don't even know. I can't even explain the whole thing in a podcast. It's just that there's a lot going on in Dwarf Fortress. Good luck. Yeah.
There's not a lot of games where I would say that the barrier of entry stopped me from playing it, but Dwarf Fortress is one of them. And it's just because, not that I think I couldn't do it. It's just like, do I want to sit down and learn this? And, you know, I actually do at some point. But it seems like it would take a bit of an investment of time and a bit of investment of patience to sit down and actually learn it. So I might get to it at some point, but Dwarf Fortress is one of the games that I would say that I looked at it and played a bit of it, and, like, you know, I want to play this, but I think there's other stuff I want to play with.
Yeah, it's a lot. All right. Matt, do you want to further talk about Castle of the Winds and any other roguelikes that you are very familiar with?
Yeah, I was talking a bit about Castle of the Winds at the top of the cast, I think. Now, Castle of the Winds is a tile-based roguelike. It's developed by SEDASoft in 1989 and distributed by Epic Mega Games in 1993, which is how I would have gotten it. It's two parts, A Question of Vengeance and Lithrancer's Bane. The first game is relatively short, and Lithrancer's Bane, Castle of Winds 2, is fairly long. You have to avenge a fallen relative, and it's very Norse-based. You have to go fight Surtur, the fire giant, at the end of it. It would be released as freeware in its entirety in 1998 by its author, Rick Seda. So if you guys have the capabilities to still play Castle of the Winds and you want to, I recommend checking it out. And I recommend it because Castle of the Winds might be one of the most newbie-friendly traditional roguelikes there are. It's a graphic roguelike, as I mentioned, but I remember looking at the back of the box, because I actually, it's one of the few games for PC I bought. I didn't actually do a whole lot of PC gaming, I guess, but Castle of the Winds was one of them, and I remember looking at the box document, the realistic graphics, and not quite, but it's fun, and I think what sets it apart from other roguelikes, number one, it has a difficulty slider, so you can play it on any difficulty. I've beaten it on the hardest difficulty, but it also has multiple save slots, so yeah, I guess it's easy to scum in that respect, because you know you might wake up to a smirking sneak thief stealing all the copper out of your purse, but you want to load it up.
Just load up a new save.
You know, if you're that kind of player, you can do that. It's got a cool magic system. It has, fairly decent loot system. Very basic roguelike. Very basic. I think a lot of folks that grew up in the 80s and 90s, this might have been their first roguelike because it was distributed fairly, wide by Epic Mega Games, in the same places where you get any kind of shareware stuff. So you might have come across it. It was the first roguelike I played, so that's really why I want to bring it up, because it's the first one I played, and it was such a smooth transition into that kind of gameplay that, it's a fun game, but it's very accessible in that respect. So if you're looking for a roguelike to get you started, Castle of Winds is the way to go. On the completely opposite side of the spectrum, probably my favorite roguelike is Iter Vehemens Ad Nisium, which, Ivan, it's Latin for a violent road to death. And
That is a great name.
It is a brutal, brutal game. It's sort of a parody of roguelikes. Like, it's almost silly how you can die. Like, you can get your groin severed in a bear trap and such. So it's very unique in that respect, and it's a graphical roguelike, not for the faint of heart. Not for the faint of heart at all. Unfortunately, I think 2005 is the last time it was updated. It's a special game to me because I found it with a buddy in that university, and we kind of played it together alongside and kind of compared characters and kind of had sort of a competition going on at that time. My first death was vomiting on a shopkeeper and getting killed by everyone in town, and his first death was eating a giant spider and getting poisoned to death, so
I think your death was far more interesting.
Yeah, but who eats a giant poisonous spider? My first death was because, oh man, there's a vomit button in this game. I've got to do it. This might provoke a hostile reaction. You don't do this? No. Don't provoke the people in Ivan unless you're prepared for them. But just to show how brutal Ivan is, it has a limb system. So you can injure limbs independently, and your vomit, if you decide to vomit, or if you're sick and you vomit, your vomit is acidic, and you can melt your own leg off if you walk and vomit with your boots on. It's brutal. It's a brutal, brutal game. And why it's so brutal, and I mentioned that this is the kind of game you do not want to run into Unique in, because if you run into Sharrax, the Mistress Queen, or Iskaladir, the Archmage, you are fucked. And it's based on, your sort of personal challenge rating. I forget what they actually call it in the game, but, the gear that you have and your statistics kind of add up to that. And if you have a lot of endurance, you have a lot of health. And if you have a lot of health, then the big guys start coming out to kill you. And so You might get polymorphed into a giant dark frog and have a shitload of health and be really powerful, but because you're that powerful, Iskallader might spawn and blast the hell out of you. It's like a very, very, very dangerous roguelike, but it's got its own kind of way to train your character in, and different tricks you can do to, sort of tilt things in your favor. I haven't actually beaten Ivan because I didn't know these sort of tricks, but I might give it a good old-fashioned go now that I know them. I kind of liked playing it when I didn't know much, and some of the deaths that you have, you know, your head is severed and it's ridiculous. And so a lot of roguelikes pride themselves on being fair. Ivan's not necessarily fair all the time. And, like, especially when you open the door, you kick a door and there's a landmine nearby. It's out to kill you, and it does a good job of it. So people might be asking out there, why do you like it so much? And it's because, you know, I really, really like this game because you don't know what's going to happen. You know generally that this kind of creature is in this floor of this dungeon, but you don't know what's going to happen. It's got that mystery. It's got that air of danger that's sort of intoxicating, I guess, to the player. It's very much a one more try kind of game. Like, especially later, like, dark frogs later in the game can teleport your limbs and items away, and it's like you can get leprosy in the game and your limbs will fall off, then you pray to the nature goddess and you get like an amethyst arm, and all of a sudden you got this fucking 30 arm strength or something. You got this amethyst arm. Oh, I love it. I love the game, and I can't recommend it enough, but I also have to flavor it with player beware, because it wants to kill you dead, and it's not as fair about it as some of the other roguelikes we've mentioned. So, again, people might be saying, like, why do you like this game again?
Sounds like a wild experience.
It's so special to me because of the circumstances surrounding it, and it's my little brother actually beat a variant of it, so it's beatable. The variant is longer, but maybe has better gear. And he came closer to me to finishing the main game than I have. But here's the thing, like, if you take the head of El Puri, the Master Dark Frog, back to Atnum and win, there's still another couple of floors after El Puri that you can try to fight this character. Or you can beat that character and come back to Atnum and decide to fight the priest, and who is a very tough opponent. So there's endings beyond the main ending. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? Can I do it? Who knows? But I've been playing it, like, off and on for, 10 years now or something. So, I guess I found it just after it kind of ended development. So I've been playing it for a decade, and every once in a while I'll say, hey, I haven't played Ivan in a couple months. I'll go back and play it. Then a couple of an hour or two later, I've had my fill for the night. I've had enough punishment.
And then you'll come back to it a few more months later.
Yeah, exactly. But that, coming back to the roguelikes thing, we'll talk about that again in our final thoughts. What I want to touch on just briefly before we end this segment is the roguelikes again, or the, you know, games with roguelike elements. You have any experience with any other than Spelunky?
The other game I'm most familiar with in terms of roguelites is FTL, Faster Than Light, where you have a selection of ships that always remain constant. As far as I know, I've only gotten, like, the first two, because this is another game I'm not exactly great at. But the ship layouts are always the same. You have a crew, you can have them manage certain rooms, but the path you take, avoiding and moving gradually away from the Federation that's after you, is randomized. Like, you have 8 different sections, but within each sections is a path that is completely different each time. Maybe the path will split 3 times, and one of them will be a shop, or maybe 2 of them are going to be certain situations where you can get possibly a new party member, or you'll get damage to your ship. And then within the huge path itself, sometimes you might end up in a hostile galaxy, or you might end up in a nebula, where the path is kind of obscured from you, and your ship might go through some very bad situations, like maybe your oxygen might be turned off, so you really want to get out of there. So that element has the rogue-like elements about just the randomized paths and just your encounters, really.
Yeah, so I was looking at FTL before, and I was looking at examples of roguelites or roguelike element games. That sounds like a neat game that I should try at some point as well.
It's also another One More Run game.
Yeah. We'll be talking about One More Run in just a moment. I mean, I guess I've played a lot of roguelites or roguelike-likes or games with roguelike elements recently. Like I mentioned, Abyss Odyssey was like that. Sometimes it was detriment, the random procedurally generated levels. And Rogue Legacy, I guess, is the big one that I've mentioned a couple times. And that's another game I can't recommend enough, because that is a fantastic game. And it kind of handles the permadeath differently than others. Like, when your character dies, they actually die, and you see their progeny. Like, once your hero dies, you then are able to select from one of their three kids to continue the quest. And they each have traits, and these traits could be, you know, genetic traits that can hinder or help their quest, depending on your playstyle and depending on the severity of the trait. Like, some make the game really tough. Like, there's a nostalgic trait that kind of puts everything in a sepia tone, which is actually bad because it becomes a bit more difficult to discern things. And there's other traits that make you, like, really large, but that also means you are harder to knock back, or you might have more knockback power yourself. So I don't want to get into all the traits, because what part of the fun of Rogue Legacy is playing through and seeing what each new generation brings you. The class, the traits, and the subweapon of your progeny are all random. So you might have been a paladin, but you might give birth to an assassin and two mages or something. So it's a really fun game. It's a platformer. It kind of subverts the permadeath thing, and you can get upgrades to boost future generations. Like, as long as you get enough gold or find enough treasure to boost your next generation, you're kind of doing well in this. It's a game that rewards skill and familiarity, but also has that random element. So you're always interested in seeing what's happening next to this. We've kind of mentioned this before with the games you were talking about, the specific roguelikes we were talking about, that it's sort of a one more game mentality. We've sort of already touched on it, but in general, why do you think we keep coming back to roguelikes?
It's really the possibility that next run will be the run. You've learned a couple of things from each death, and then you feel like you finally get it. Maybe your first floor and crawl will be kind of empty and you'll get some good equipment. So maybe this run will be the one where you get pretty far, but then you get to the second floor and then there are three worms on you or something and you can't avoid them in time.
Now, in the grand scheme of things, do you like roguelikes? And in the grand scheme, how do you like them compared to other gaming experiences that are more
Set in stone, yeah. I can't really say I like it more or less than other games, but after this cast, I think it's pretty obvious that I like them a lot. They really bring something different, like, really, other than the fact that they're randomly generated, but yeah, they just do offer a different experience than something where I know that this dungeon comes after this dungeon. Just the element of surprise is what brings me back.
Right, and I guess I can agree that I don't specifically like roguelikes more than other games. Like any game, the roguelike has to be good. Like, you can brutalize me in your game and have all these roguelike elements. It doesn't mean I'm going to like it. I mentioned Ivan before. Like, I keep playing Ivan because it has a great loot system. It has, you know, really funny situations and things like that. There's lots more to it that, again, yes, you want to see the possibilities of what that next run will be. But, you know, sometimes I want just to play something that has, you know, like you said, set in stone, or
sometimes I want to play R-Type, where I need to memorize the entire stage.
Or Gradius, or friggin' Ogre Battle, I guess. You know, you want to play another kind of game, but they all have to be good. So I think roguelikes are good, but being a roguelike doesn't necessarily mean that you're good. I like that Berlin definition of roguelike as well, but I think there's flexibility involved there, and honestly, as far as contention about the definition of roguelike is concerned, I think people should just forget the semantics and just fucking enjoy a game for once. That's really what I gotta say about disagreements on semantics when it comes to video games. Just enjoy the game.
Sometimes you really need a genre like roguelike light, because what does that even mean at that point?
Yeah. Well, folks, thanks for listening to our Roguelikes podcast. I hope we didn't sound too much like pretentious pricks. I find that when I start talking about game, like the theory and aspects of games, I can sound like that, but I hope I didn't. I hope we were convinced you that they're cool games, you should give them a try.
Matt, I think every time we have a podcast, I think we're pretentious, so I think at this point I've just accepted it.
Well, if you want to reach me, you can reach me at twitter.com/Mattazoic, MATTOZOYC. It's like the Mesozoic era, except the dinosaurs are better. Also, my website is Mattazoic.com. Same deal. Great dinosaurs. Yeah. Where can we reach you, Chris?
You can reach me at twitter.com/Karasu, CAWRASU.
And where can we tweet the Arrowcast?
You can tweet our dear horse at twitter.com/agrocast, AGROCAST.
Now, should we beware the Ides of March or not?
Well, I guess that's going to be something we're looking forward to, because we're playing a fresh new game that both of us have been sitting on for probably a year that we've decided to cover for the podcast now. We'll be covering Double Fine's Broken Age. It is a point-and-click adventure. I'm actually not familiar with it at all, except that I backed it. I should probably play it now.
Yeah, you know what? I've been waiting for an excuse to play it, I guess, and sometimes I think about it and I'm like, yeah, I want to play this or that. So this is a great excuse to play it. I don't know anything about it either. So, except that, like, Elijah Wood's in it or something. So, well,
that's more information than I know.
Yeah, so, like, I guess it's good to play it and not have it spoiled on us since we backed it. So, we'll give that a spin in a month's time, and we'll talk about it then, and we'll see you folks again then, or not so much see you as have you listen to us. Cheers.
Sweet, serene voices. Cheers.